Oh my God, that was so exciting.
Yeah.
We figured out music.
So fancy.
All together as a team.
Like a family.
That was pretty much, I did that. I came in and I.
Thank you. But you know what? I actually wanted to make it fancy for you because you're here today. Ben Mankiewicz is here today.
Ooh.
And Alonzo Duraldi is here today.
Hi.
I'm Christy, and this is still What the Flick from the comfy confines of my dining room table.
Yes, it is.
We're drinking tea. It's cold out. It's fall. It's autumnal.
It's like 80.
Yeah, it's L.A. fall.
Yeah.
It is, but, you know. But
I'm wearing a layer.
It is cold in the morning. Like, there's such a dramatic, and, you know, I get up so freaking early now. There's a dramatic difference, like 7:15 to 9.
Yeah.
It can go from 61 and like, ooh, to all of a sudden you're like, oh, that's right, I live in L.A. and it's always hot.
The flannel robe is back.
So you tuned in for film reviews and you got meteorology. What don't we do? Anyway, this is still What the Flick. I'm really happy to be here with you guys. I'm so happy to see you, Ben. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
What have you been doing?
I've not been. I went to a couple of film festivals. Films festival, I think is the plural.
Attorneys General.
Yeah. The Lone Pine Film Festival, which is like the cowboy film festival. Lone Pine's about 3 hours inland. And I don't know. I don't remember. If you count television episodic productions, something like 2,000 westerns have been shot.
Wow.
In Lone. It looks like everything. I mean, it's beautiful.
Where is it?
It's like at the foot of Mount, at the base of Mount Whitney. And
so, like, if you can't afford Monument Valley, this is where you go.
That's right, yeah. And it is a poor man's Monument Valley, but you want to have a gunfight in the rocks and have your guy hide from people shooting at him, then this is the place to go. So, and I was interviewing Robert Wagner there because
because you're buddies.
We're friends, and he's I like RJ. Everybody who likes everybody calls him RJ. So and he was really great friends with my cousin Tom, who created the show Heart to Heart. So we're interviewing him and Scott Iman, who has written 3 books with him, and Iman has also written books on John Wayne and John Ford and Louis B. Mayer, and so and we screened this movie Broken Lance, where RJ is a young contract player at Fox, plays Spencer Tracy's son by his second marriage. Richard Widmark and a couple other guys are the sort of distrusting sons of the first marriage, and so there's conflict. But, you know, it's got Spencer Tracy and Richard Widmark. It's not a throwaway Western, right? And it's pretty good. Cati Jurado is in it as the second wife.
Look at you with the Spanish pronunciation.
Spanish I speak. French. I mean, I just got a direct message from a professional person who we would all know of and respect, who was sent me the Google translation for the French director Eric Rohmer, whose name it would appear I have been mispronouncing for some time.
Oh God, did you say Rohmer?
No, no, that would have been worse. I just said Rohmer.
That's what I've been saying.
That's correct.
No, not according to the translation, according to this guy who's a junkie.
Oh, dear, because I just did like 10 of his movies on Filmstruck.
I think someone would have told you.
You know what? I feel better. Like, if I'm in the mass of mispronunciation, I can live with it. I'll play it for you.
Okay.
Anyway, so this is a long way of getting. So I'm talking to him, and there's a great story that RJ tells in his books, and he's told before, because when he was making Titanic, he began an affair, like a year-long affair, with Barbara Stanwyck.
The 50s Titanic with Clifton Webb.
Yes, that's right. He was very close to Clifton Webb, too, sort of a mentor to him. But the affair was with Barbara Stanwyck, worth mentioning.
Could have gone either way.
Yeah, could have gone either way. That's right, that's right. Both probably interested. So I asked him a question. I go, give me a sense of what it was like to be a contract player for the studios in the 50s, right? And he was incredibly handsome. And he said it was great. And I go, well, okay, but sometimes they did try to sort of control the image very carefully. And I'm trying to get him to tell a story. He made a movie the year before with Terry Moore. And during production or shortly after production, the studio leaked to the papers that Terry Moore and Robert Wagner were engaged to be married. They'd never even been on a date, right? And they didn't call and check with him first either. But Terry Moore was having an affair with Howard Hughes, and it was coming apart or becoming public, and they needed
a cover story.
They did it a cover story. And so nobody's talking about she's not involved with Howard Hughes. She's going to get married to Robert Wagner. And they're both great looking. And, they love each other. And so
under contract at Fox.
He reads it in the Herald Examiner or whatever L.A. paper ran the story. And so he goes and sees Terry Moore. And she's crying because of the difficulty of the breakup. And then I'm trying to get him to say, and someone else was very upset to read about this in the paper without knowing about it ahead of time. And he's like, who? And I go, the person you were seeing who maybe didn't love reading about your involvement with a younger, age-appropriate woman. And he says to Scott, his Iman, he goes, who was I seeing? And Scott mouths, Barbara. And he's like, oh, yeah, I was dating Barbara Stanwyck. And even though it's public, like, people still are like, oh, right, you know, And then he won't talk about that. I mean, he will, but he just gets distracted. And I'm thinking, oh, he's not going to tell any fun story here. And then he says, you know, Barbara was a big Western star, of course, later in her career. And she loved this place. She loved Lone Pine. Do you know her ashes are scattered here?
Oh.
And literally the crowd goes, I mean, they gasp. I've seldom been in a room where people gasp. And I look out, and some people know, but 80% of that crowd was like, oh, my God, Barbara. And I think, okay, there's no way that story's true. But, I mean, it's just I stumbled into this great, great moment in a Q&A that I didn't know was coming. And we looked it up. And if you believe the internet, also, yeah.
Did you find them? Did you, like, go?
No, I only found out. It was, I was.
Like a marker where they used to
be. It's been a while.
I left
the floods came.
No, but there's a spot. You can go to where Barbara Stanwyck's ashes are scattered in Lone Pine, California. So apparently the place did mean a lot to her.
That is a good thing to do on Halloween. See what I did there?
Segway queen.
Yes. So anyway, we're happy to see you. And it's nice to have Ben here because Ben has seen Halloween. And we've all seen Halloween. And we have a lot of film reviews today. But the big one of the week is Halloween. And it is kind of a reboot. And it's kind of a sequel. And it kind of erases the fact that there have been like a good solid dozen Halloween films between now and the original Halloween 40 years ago.
I like that decision. To just say, like, we have an important franchise, but the first one's the only one that's important. It doesn't mean...
The first one's the only one that counts.
That's
like,
right.
They are literally, like, not taking...
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying the first one's the only one that really matters.
Yeah.
And even though some of the others, I understand, a couple of them people like. It's not a judgment on the artistic merits of those films, but just they were like, it doesn't matter. Like you can do anything. It's a reminder that you can do anything with these movies. And just they decided, no, there was that Halloween, and then nothing else happened. Sorry. And we're starting over as if this is the only sequel.
But right. They actually do acknowledge the fact that, you know, important canonical decisions were made that they acknowledge and then do away with. Like,
right.
So I'll just start from the beginning. So Jamie Lee Curtis is back, right? Michael Myers is back. It's been 40 years since the first Halloween, and so we acknowledge that there was an original Halloween, and he has been institutionalized ever since. While he is being transferred to a different facility, of course he gets out, and all hell breaks loose, and he goes to try to find Laurie Strode. She has been preparing for this moment for her entire life because she has fortified herself. She has fortified her home and her daughter, played by Judy Greer, and strengthened her and prepared her, like, look, something's going to happen. I mean, she's essentially like, you know, a hunkered down conspiracy theorist, you know, with her bunker and her weapons.
She is basically the T2 Sarah Connor.
She is.
She knows something bad's going to happen,
right.
And she does nothing but prepare for it.
Right. So, of course, and she's not wrong to do that because Michael Myers does get out and he does come after her. And so, and it happens to do it on Halloween, you know, happens to do it on the anniversary of the very night that, you know, the original events happened. But it acknowledges early on the fact that, you know, there were rumors that Michael Myers was actually Laurie Strode's daughter.
Brother.
That's different. That'd be a whole other movie. Mm. But David Gordon Green directed this, and he co-wrote the script with Danny McBride. They are old friends. They all went to college together in North Carolina with Jody Hill and Craig Zobel, and they're all buddies, and so they work together quite a bit. It might seem weird to have David Gordon Green direct a Halloween movie, but he, at this point, has really made every kind of movie from his beginning in indies, like George Washington and All the Real Girls, to, you know, stoner comedies like Pineapple Express. I forgot about Your Highness. Yeah.
And then The Sitter.
Oh, yeah. And then he's returned to his indie roots with stuff like Joe.
Prince Avalanche.
Yeah, Prince Avalanche. So,
That really good one with Al Pacino that nobody saw.
I don't remember.
It has a name like Marwin Call. It's one of those like mouthful names that no one can remember, but I liked it very much.
Anyway, so I am not a giant Halloween fan, so nothing about this like upsets me in terms of any inconsistency that may result from, you know, the script here. They acknowledge its place and yet reinvent everything in some ways. It's starting with the title sequence, which is a really cool play on the origins of the Halloween film. It's a decaying pumpkin coming back to life as the John Carpenter score plays. And just even the first few notes, as you guys heard, even from the very first few notes, it still is so chilling. You know, it still really, it really grabs you. So this is not really scary, I would say. I mean, it has moments of tension, increasingly has moments of tension, but what is appealing here is watching Jamie Lee Curtis just be a badass again.
There are moments of tension, and there are some parts where it is sort of a scary movie. I was mostly annoyed by this movie.
You were? How come?
Well, partially, I don't think they really give Jamie Lee Curtis all that much to do.
No, she does one thing, and sort of, you know, right? She's become understandably, she's a survivalist, and everything she does is in survivalist mode. And Dave, one moment shot from behind where she sort of rests her shoulder on her granddaughter's, rests her head on her granddaughter's shoulder.
But yeah, so it's like, so she's playing this sort of PTSD character, which is an interesting choice, but it's all they give her to do, and she's off screen for a lot of the film. I think this is really being sold as like Jamie Curtis taking back the role and da-da-da. And apparently, you know, even though David Gordon Green's been saying in interviews that, oh, she was involved in the script process, like, no, she wasn't. Like, she read it, she signed on, and that was it. I also think that the fact that they're making a Halloween movie means that, you know, you're basically trying to tread on what is a great horror movie. And it's not like that I care that they're messing with the narrative or whatever. Like, that's fine. Like, fine, ignore the sequels, whatever. But if the second you say, like, I'm making a follow-up to this, like, movie that rewrote the rules of horror, and then I'm just going to make an okay horror movie, that's kind of a letdown, you know? It's sort of like if you tried to make a Rosemary's Baby follow-up or something. Like, you can't just half-ass it. It has to be something really special, or why bother? And then finally, there's, you know, the movie shows you that, like, Judy Greer had an abusive childhood, basically, that she was raised in fear, in panic, in paranoia.
And emotionally, she was withheld.
Exactly. And then the movie is like, but it was a good idea, because look,
she was right. Yeah. Mom was right.
You know, like Judy Greer's whole thing is like, you know what? The world isn't all terrible, isn't a constant waking nightmare. And then the movie's like, no, it is.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Although, you know, I don't know that this movie bears the responsibility of having to justify or excoriate a parent for raising their children that way. Like, yes, you're right, and a real movie, of which this sort of isn't, then a parent, a child raised under that sort of, you know, sort of the oppressive, bleak version of humanity, where death could come get you at any second, would be interesting, and we'd care much more how that character adjusted. But, you know, this is designed so that when she and Toby Hull, right, as her husband, right?
Toby Huss, sorry.
So that when Toby Huss, who's great and is always funny, and
Artie, sure, the strongest man in the world from The Adventures of Pete and Pete.
So that when they go, you know, oh, what are you talking about, Mom? The world's a wonderful place and people are caring. And it's just so we'll all laugh at that,
I guess. But it's just like, if you're going to bring it up, then it's not like I'm stretching to find this. This is talked about in the movie. So, you know, also the notion that I forgot the other thing. Anyway, we'll come back to it.
I do like, and maybe this is partly Jamie Lee Curtis's influence here at all, is that the women fight for themselves. Like, yes, they don't need the men. The men are particularly helpful.
No.
And it's not a spoiler to say that there's a final girl, you know. I mean, that's what the structure of these films always is. But the women do not need the men to end up as a final girl.
No, the men are all, every single one of them, incompetent.
Yeah.
They are all unable. And partly, and one of the reasons why I'm thinking of lowering my grade is that part of this comes from, like, a very late reaction. We have a couple of characters sort of led by Will Patton, mm-hmm, who I guess was in the first one, right?
No.
No? All right. Well, they pretend he was.
The character.
Oh, he couldn't have been, right? But,
he's a sheriff deputy.
Right, but he was the first to arrive on the scene in 1978, so we're told narratively. And then, so he recognizes, along with the doctor, Who's been treating Michael Myers, and
who is called the new Loomis,
right?
By Jimmy Lee,
and came along on the bus ride that went wrong, and we don't even know what happened on the bus ride. There's one line sort of explaining what happened, but that could have been a fugitive like escape scene that we don't get that scene. But they recognize the danger, as does the chief of police, who's also sort of who's a clown type character wearing a cowboy hat the entire movie. But none of them react the way any public official would in this situation.
No.
Escaped maniac, violent escaped maniac on the loose. We're actually going to send in, we're going to blanket this town with...
Yeah, returning to the scene of the crime.
And we're gonna have 75 cops there. We're calling in the National Guard. They're kids out on Halloween. It would not. It doesn't stretch credulity that they would overreact to this. And this might have called for an overreaction. Instead, it's like, well, there's like three cops driving around town seeing if Mike Myers is around.
And maybe they should have on the front end had more protection on that bus, right?
For starters.
It's just like a regular bus. I mean, they're chained to the bus, but, you know, nothing can control Michael Myers, of course.
And the thing is, like, the movie raises the sort of interesting idea that, like, he's been waiting all this time, you know, to escape, to get her. And she's been waiting all this time for him to escape and come get her. And so there's this sort of weird kind of mutually assured destruction thing happening, which is a cool idea. But then the movie explains it like four times. Like, in case that somebody in the back row didn't pick up on this subplot. Like, they keep saying it. It's like, oh my God, we get it, movie.
They are doomed to find each other. I also think that the Danny McBride influence is felt here in the humor. There's like random splashes of dark humor. I want to give a shout out to Jibrail Nontambu, who is the foul mouth kid that's being babysat on Halloween night.
Yes,
he's very funny.
He's very good. Yes.
And characters like that and moments like that, I think are Danny McBride's comic influence in here. Like, it's kind of smart ass and it's kind of like inappropriate in the face of what's supposed to be scary. And
And there's I regret saying this as soon as it comes out of my mouth, but there's a so I'm not going to say it. He's not just a foul mouthed kid. Like, he is. There is a sweetness to him and a likability. Like, there's a believability.
He and the babysitter have a good rapport.
It's actually really. It's fun. It's the funniest scene in the movie, but it's also quite a nice scene.
Yeah, and then he disappears from the movie.
And then he disappears from the movie completely.
Yeah. My other beef is that this is one of the few times I've ever thought, wow, this is not a good Judy Greer performance.
Well, she is a different Judy Greer performance because we know her mostly from comedy.
Yeah, but I mean, she was great in The Descendants.
She was.
You know, it wasn't the genre. It was the fact that, like, she would say a line and be like, nope, I don't believe you. It was literally just kind of falling flat. And I was like, you're great, and even you are not good at this.
Yeah, so her husband, Toby Huss, had more sort of a little bit more Judy Greerness in this than Judy Greer did. It's like their part should have been swapped.
Yeah.
Their attitudes.
I was really let down because I was...
Are you a big fan of the Halloween movies?
I'm a big fan of the original one, and I think some of the sequels have some merit. I think actually Halloween H2O, which was the 20th anniversary movie, as opposed to this being the 40th anniversary movie, is actually better and gives Laurie Strode more of a character, more stuff to do.
That's the last one she was in, right?
Yes. And it's a much better movie, I think. So are we recording?
Yeah.
Okay.
Look, the numbers are going up.
Okay. It looked like it wasn't moving. I couldn't tell. So I don't know. I was really kind of let down by this. And it's weird because, you know, David Gordon Green for a very long time was going to remake Suspiria.
Oh, well, yeah, which we'll talk about in the show next week.
We'll talk about next week. But, like, yeah, so now between this and that, I'm like, okay, everybody stop with the remakes.
Go away from the 40-year-old horror classics. The 70s were their own special time.
Let them be.
We cannot recreate them. So I found it tense. There's one particular scene in the upstairs part of Laurie's house that's particularly tense. But it's never really scary. It's gory, and sometimes it's tense, but... Was I frightened? No.
I thought you were.
It's well made.
Your arms were, you know, you looked like Donald Trump for some of that.
Was I frowny face Trump during the whole movie?
You were hugging yourself.
I was having a news conference I didn't want to have.
Yeah, right. People were asking me questions that I didn't want to answer. I thought it was tense. I was, you know, those movies, they mean nothing to me. I didn't see the first one until I was, I'm sure, in my 20s. And as always, as this case that after, because I saw, I love The Eagle Has Landed. so every time I see Donald Pleasance in anything except The Great Escape, I think, hey, look, Himmler.
Blofeld.
Right. No, but it's, to me, it's Himmler. Himmler means it should be Blofeld, but it is always it's always Himmler.
So what are your numbers then?
So, but here's the thing that yeah. The reason why that I almost want to give two numbers here is that I don't know, and maybe it's the everything can be blamed on the political climate, which seems a safe way of not ascribing blame to one side, but I do put it on one side. So that we're I hate seeing people suffer before death. Like, I don't like it. I don't enjoy it. It stays with me, and not in the way that, oh, you must have made a good movie, you're still thinking about it, but in the way that I can't sleep and I think about my family, what it would be like if it's one thing to die, it's another thing to know in the 60 seconds or 6 hours before your death that death is imminent, and that we're sort of, that's part of, that's a critical part of the narrative of these movies. Hate it. I don't ever want to see one ever again as long as I live.
Well, we're going to talk about another one later on in the show.
And I want to protect, like, my kid from ever seeing them. Like, I don't like it. I don't. I get it. And it's different than somehow if it's, you know, an episode of Better Call Saul where we see warring drug gangs go at each other and where one of those people might get shot and know the end is coming. I can handle that better than...
They signed on to something that was going to be dangerous.
Sure, and then innocence snatched from their idyllic life and then menaced horribly until the end, and that is and I find that now excruciating, and that wasn't always the case. I don't know whether I've become a wimp, but I don't like it, and I don't ever want to see it again.
Okay, well, there are a lot of movies that try to expose us to that in the name of thrills or trying to say something mm-hmm. about society, and we're going to talk about 22 July later on in the show, which is about a real terrorist mm-hmm. attack, and
it was,
so
it was similar, but that happened, and we're not supposed to there's no titillation with that, whereas here there is.
It's meant to be exciting.
It's meant to be exciting. Yeah. In 22 July, it's very much not exciting.
Well, so then what are your two very different numbers then?
A one.
Okay.
but we'll dismiss that because I get it. That's a very particular concern. And I'm dropping it. 6.9.
Okay.
So just drop it 1 point.
All right. So I'm saying 7. Ben's saying 6.9.
I said 5.5. The number stays the same, actually.
Okay.
Because I just, you know, I admire the people involved, but I feel like it's a no-win situation to try and step into making a movie like the original Halloween, and what we're left with, even on its own merits, doesn't all work.
Because our number is 6.5. It's at 83% on the tomato meter right now, which sounds kind of high. Maybe that will change.
I think it mostly delivers what it sets out to deliver.
So let's talk about 22 July now, since we are on the topic of, you know, painful images to watch. Ben, do you want to describe it?
I mean, it's the story from Paul Greengrass, who I guess produced, wrote, and directed it, right? Yeah, did it all. Of the Oslo attacks on the 22nd of July 2011,
yep.
Right? First in Oslo, killing 8 people with a bomb. I looked at the CCTV footage. That's exactly what happened.
Hmm. Well, that's important to him usually. Paul Greengrass likes to get those details right.
Right, yeah. You learned from United 93, not Flight 93.
United 93 and Captain Phillips.
And Captain Phillips, yeah. But particularly United 93 was...
Those Bourne movies.
Right, exactly. Just as they happened.
Very lifelike.
More sadistically went about 40 miles away, I think, to an island where a group of kids, sort of an event, summer camp sponsored by the Labour Party in Norway, where the kids were, and he killed 69 more people there. And it's the story of that. 77 total, 69.
Oh, I see, you're
69
right.
Yeah. On the island, 8 in Oslo. And it's the story of that event. And then mostly it's because it's pretty long. It's 220, 215 anyway. And
it's long for you.
So the event is done with early. And then it's about sort of the trial and the recovery and the PTSD of a couple of the survivors of that attack.
One thing that's kind of daring about this movie is that it really tries to get into the mind of the killer. And I want to look up what the actors' names are who all play these people, because it doesn't want you necessarily to sympathize with him, but he is humanized more so than you might expect in a movie about someone who is clearly an absolute monster who, like, really enjoyed inflicting massive amounts of pain and suffering on the world in the name of his ideology. He was this right-wing nationalist, extremist, white supremacist, and he was part of, you know, a larger movement that we have now seen reverberations of. They refer to other groups throughout Europe. They refer to Stormfront here in the United States in the film.
I thought white right-wingers were like, you know, lone wolves and never terrorists.
Right. As it turns out, though, this guy, although he'd been affiliated with this, I mean, he's a loner because, of course, he's a giant loser, as they all are. Anders Danielsson Lee, or okay. Lie, is his name. Him. Yeah, he has the same first name as the actual killer.
Anders Breivik is the killer. Yeah.
And I read a story about the other sort of lead in this is playing one of the kids who was shot, Jonas Strand. They're all Norwegian actors. Jonas Strand
Gravli
as Viljar Hansen.
Viljar. He was very good.
Viljar Hansen, who was shot 5 times and survived, blinded in one eye. It could die at any moment. Still today, there's loose bullet fragments so close to his brainstem that they say heading a soccer ball or falling could kill him. And it's about his sort of recovery. But he, much of the movie is about his recovery, both mentally and physically, from this. But he said that he was very pleased with the film because it humanized Anders.
Interesting.
That was critical to think that this wasn't just some
monster.
Crazy, mad monster. He said monster that we can then dismiss. His point overall was, hey, man, he walks among us.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think the correct, Greengrass, effectively, that's one of the most effective parts of the movie.
Yeah, and surprising, too, because, it would be so easy to just assign, like, monster status. Like, we can't understand this, and we're not going
to
bother.
Yeah.
Right. And he's just frightening, and we can all unite around that. But making him a human being and externalizing his ideology is really, it's disturbing, but it's also fascinating. And it gives this movie more emotional heft than, in more complexity, I should say, than you might expect.
Yeah, because he really explains his ideology in a way that makes sense. It doesn't make sense, the things he says, but he says it like a rational person. It clearly does make sense to him. Like, you understand immediately, well, this guy really thinks this. He thinks, the elites and the immigrants and, I'm not sure the word comes out, but the Jews, the elites, the immigrants and the Jews, they're and everybody of color, they're coming to get us. So obviously I need to hit them where it hurts most, he says. And this is much of the dialogue of the trial is from the transcript.
Mm-hmm.
So, Sam Greengrass, really critical to him to use the actual words. So when this guy says what I thought, I needed to hit him where it hits him worse. These are the future elite leaders who are going to screw us. So I'm going to kill these kids, the mm-hmm. children of the elite, and they'll hear my message.
Right. And it's fascinating that he didn't want to take the insanity plea. He wanted to be on trial to explain that very thing, to explain what he was thinking, because, he thinks he's right. And saying, I'm crazy, totally undercuts what he views as his own power behind his choices here. And he did plan it out very methodically, and that's what the first half hour of the film is. And I was pleasantly surprised to find that it's not as much shaky cam as you might expect, and which is often Paul Greengrass's stylistic choice is that, you're in it. You're in the middle of it. And yes, you are in the middle of it here, too, but not in ways that are, intentionally disorienting and kind of dizzying.
I think he felt very – it seemed like a director who felt very conscious of the fact that he was showing and taking us to the murder of 69 children, defenseless children, and that sort of making it stylish – again, to go back to the point I made about Halloween, it just doesn't feel right.
Right.
So,
I mean, sensationalize it somehow.
Somehow. So, it's still terrifying and it's still awful, but it doesn't feel showy.
Yeah.
And is it meant to like, sort of distancing to kind of just give the audience a break? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's right at the beginning of the movie. It's hard to know. I mean, you know, like you're showing the murder of children. They don't overdo it. I mean, you see a lot of kids after they've been shot, and from a distance you see a lot of children go down, but you're not with somebody
as
they get shot. And
yeah,
it's not overly bloody.
Yeah, no, it's quick and it's efficient. But really the bulk of it is the way out of that. And this family, Villar and his family, they are our through line into this massive the sea of sadness and anger. There is a trial. You see Villar's physical rehabilitation. You see, you know, how his family reacts. You see how his little brother reacts, who is also there.
He saved his little brother.
Yeah, and the little brother has guilt, but he also... Anyway, I won't explain it all, but he has conflicting emotions about...
He's got survivor's guilt. There's a lot. They definitely explore survivor's guilt from the brother. And then from another woman, a Kurdish refugee, also obviously true, mm-hmm. another woman who survived who was sort of involved, right, with Villar. Wasn't she sort of, they seemed to, there was romance.
There's like a friendship, maybe more there, yeah.
And she survived, and her sister is killed right in the beginning, mm-hmm. and sort of she says in the trial, I don't understand, I'm paraphrasing, I don't understand why she's dead and I'm alive.
Yeah, and they take the trial seriously, and there's one long monologue that Villar gives when he finally like gets the courage. He summons it all up to go onto the stand and face this killer, and he says what he was wanting to say all this time. It's very understated in the way that Greengrass shoots it and the way it's edited and the way that this monologue is delivered. There's a great deal of emotional truth to it, and this is subject matter that could have been depicted in kind of like an overly melodramatic way, and it never is. I was impressed by the restraint of it and the emotional truth of it. Jonas Strand-Gravely is excellent as Villar. That one speech really is so good.
I have a question. So I haven't seen the movie yet. Now, this is on Netflix. Most people will probably watch it on Netflix. Is it okay on Netflix?
Yes.
Or should I hold out for like an award season big screen?
You can watch it on Netflix.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of dreading this, both from a subject matter perspective and also just the length of it. It is like nearly 2.5 hours long, and it does feel at the outset like, ugh, I don't want to watch this, all these kids being killed. But it really picks up and is more complicated than you might expect at the outset.
Oh, yeah, it's much more complicated. And just the of Villar's family, like, you know, the way that they're torn apart. His mother is, at the time it happens, is running for mayor. You know, these are all real idealistic kids. These are sort of, it's a leadership summit for, you know, like future Norwegian leaders. And so they're there at this camp to talk about like, hey, the world's changing. And they're, you know, there's one of these, the girl who he's sort of friends with, she is a Kurdish refugee. And when they came over, she was like, you know, she says that we were not really welcome. I didn't know if this could be my home, if this could be a place. And my sister, the one who got killed, kept saying, no, this is going to be great. This is going to be a wonderful lesson. And finally, I was starting to experience freedom. And she says at one point, again, right from the transcript, I don't know, I'm paraphrasing again, what about me makes you so afraid? Like, why am I so scary? You know, and it's a really profound thing for an 18-year-old who just lived through what she lived through to be able to say.
Yeah, it's well written, well acted. So my number is... Well, maybe you should make it more than that. So I was going to say a 7.8. I'm going to make it an 8.
I'm going to make it a 7.8, yeah.
Okay, so we're 7.9 our number. It's 79% on the tomato meter. Yeah, it is surprisingly solid. And if you're kind of dreading it, don't.
Yeah, don't. Although, you know, the beginning is terrible. But you know what's coming. And again, from the methodical planning of the explosions in Norway and in Oslo, and then to lying about being a police officer and having the kids rounded up, thinking, trusting him, you know, it's just you have this sort of sickening sense of dread. But then given that, it is handled as well as can be handled.
Yes. Okay. So 7.9 is our number. And Ben, do you have to leave us?
I do have to leave you. I haven't seen any other movies. I would like to stay. and I look forward to returning, hopefully next week.
We're happy to have you here.
Yay.
Come back.
I will. Thanks very much.
We have tea and headphones.
Even if I don't see a movie, I'm going to come back just to have a cup of tea.
Will you please?
Yeah.
On these chilly days? Okay.
Yeah.
Bye. So Alonzo and I will continue talking.
Yes.
Also, at some point, we're going to talk about the Gotham Awards because those nominations came out this morning.
Yes.
But let's move on to... Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Sure. Okay, so Can You Ever Forgive Me is based on a true story. A celebrity biographer named Lee Israel. She was a biographer of celebrities, not a celebrity herself. Having a hard time getting a book published, strapped for cash. Very antisocial kind of person, so it's not the sort of person to sort of like, you know, schmooze and become known in the New York literary scene. Discovers that there is a market for letters written by kind of, you know, celebrities, literary celebrities, and the more sort of personal they are, the better. And so she starts forging them, and she starts using her talents of getting under her subject's skin to sort of write these letters the way that Dorothy Parker would write them, the way that Noel Coward would write them, the way that Edna Ferber would write them, and, you know, makes a nice living selling these fake letters to bookstores and different sort of, you know, purveyors of this kind of literary effluvia, I guess.
Like authentic collectibles.
Collectibles, exactly, that kind of thing. Yeah. And she's helped out by Richard E. Grant, who is this sort of like shady but very charming gay coke dealer. And ultimately it all comes apart. But the movie's not so much about the caper as it is just about her and what a fascinating figure she is, and like how she relates to her cat far better than to humanity. And, you know, you see her and the cat at home a lot, and we just sort of take it for granted that she's, you know, taking care of the cat. And then the first time we see somebody enter her apartment, and it's like the smell is so overpowering they can't even take it because she's not really cleaning up after the cat all that well. And Melissa McCarthy, you know, I think the best, a lot of the best sort of comedic performances, there is this kind of undercurrent of rage to these characters, these like bigger than life, you know, nutty characters. And she really gets to tap into that here. And so there are laughs, but I mean, this is a dramatic performance and she's really good.
She's really great. And there is such sadness and such humanity to the performance. Yeah. When you see the loneliness of her house and her reality, yeah, she's really stripped down in this. She's really dowdy and really frumpy. And, yeah, kind of hilariously cantankerous in the mode of so many misanthropic New Yorkers we've seen on film, like, you know, Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets, or, you know, there's a million of them. But we also really do feel for her when we realize her desperation and her sadness and her isolation, and the thing that she and Richard E. Grant get up to with their shtick here is kind of fun, but then you realize like each of them is all the other one has,
right?
You know, and
they're both very broken.
They are, and they need each other. It's a very, this is from Mariel Heller, who did Diary of a Teenage Girl, which was so great,
and co-written by Nicole Holofcener, who I love, and Jeff Witte, who is one of the creators of Avenue Q.
Oh, okay, well, this explains a lot. Yeah, so it creates a really vivid sense of this place and time in New York, this snapshot of New York. It's like the '90s. AIDS has happened. There is a reference to Richard Grant saying a lot of his friends are dead.
Right.
It is not yet Disney-fied, Giuliani-fied New York City.
This is 1991.
Yeah. So, like, you know, Times Square is still not a place where you can go and visit with your family and have, like, a happy, good, clean time.
They haven't opened the Olive Garden yet.
There's no Olive Garden. There's no Red Lobster. Bye, Ben. We miss you. Good to see you. Come back soon. Bye.
Cheers.
There's no Disney store. There's no Dylan's Candy Bar. So it does create a vivid sense of, you know, the cramped apartments and the sad bars. And, yeah, I really liked it.
And go ahead. We need more Jane Curtin in everything.
Jane Curtin is in it, not even enough, I would say.
No, I needed at least one or two more scenes of her, but what she's in is Cherse.
Yes.
She's so good as Lee Israel, the writer's agent.
And I'm looking up, it's Dolly Wells, who is the woman at one of the bookstores who she gets a nice little friendship with.
Yes.
And she's in it in only maybe like a half dozen scenes, but there is a sadness and a loneliness to her as well, and like this open need to connect that that Lee does not have.
And a sense that the two of them might have possibly have some kind of future if it weren't for Lee's, like, alcoholism for one thing, right. And her just her crimes, but also her curmudgeonliness.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's a really great performance. There's a good collection of sort of New York character actors. Anna Deavere Smith mm-hmm. has a good scene. Steven Spinella pops up as one of the buyers. My friend Michael Cyril Creighton is one of the buyers. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's a juicy Ben Falcone role because there always is.
Yes, we can't escape him. But. Yeah, I was surprised. I did not know this story at all. Did you? Had you ever heard
this
story?
I had never heard of it, no.
Okay.
But apparently, you know, what's interesting about the movie is that assuming the voice of all these other writers sort of emboldened her to follow her own, and she eventually did write the memoir on which this movie is based.
Is it called
Can You Forgive Me? Yeah.
Yeah, and it also is so quaint because clearly now somebody could not do that, right? The technology that exists, you know, to find, you know, plagiarism technology, search mm-hmm. engines, there are ways, I think, now that it would be easier to figure out faster that these were fakes versus right. in the early 90s, it'd be easier to dupe people.
Things were still analog. Although, you know, even as the movie ends, we find out that, like, even so-called authenticators could be wrong, you know. But yeah, I think you're right. It is one of those things where when you look at like people, I mean, I guess people still pass hot checks or whatever. But yeah, generally speaking, computers have made certain crimes of yore harder to pull off now.
Yeah, and this is
to be replaced by new crimes that people
right.
do with computers.
Hacking. So yeah, and so Melissa McCarthy, I think, has tried a few times here to do something more dramatic, and the material does not always rise to her abilities or her desires, and here it finally does.
Yeah.
I feel like there's in like Identity Theft, for example. Ugh. I mean, that is a comedy. That is primarily a comedy, but there also it's that, and it's also, is it Tammy also?
Yeah.
They try to go nicey-nice with her and like humanize her and soften her, and it never works.
In my review for The Wrap, I talk about how like in so many of the movies, especially the ones that she makes with Ben Falcone, mm-hmm. that the two of them create, she plays these big, brash characters who at one point are reduced to tears about, oh, I'm so... I said, like, you could have called all of those movies Can You Ever Forgive Me? Whereas this one, she does finally have a bit of a breakdown, but it feels, Matt's not here, earned.
Yes, there's gravitas to the breakdown.
Yes, but it also feels like it's not like it's undoing everything the character was about. It's sort of about her realizing that she's taken things too far, that she's, you know, used her talents in a, you know, for ill instead of for good. And so I bought it here, you know, and it's not like she has to apologize for everything about her. It's just that she has to apologize for being a forger. You know?
Yeah. And there are glimmers of humanity here and there. Like, she's not just misanthropic and she's not just cruel or insulting. She is those things, but she has a nice friendship with the landlord and with the landlord's mom, which is sort of unexpected. So, you know, and the things that she will do for her cat, you know, that show the humanity in her that she tries really hard to tamp down.
In
there.
And again, in those scenes with Dolly Wells, you know, mm-hmm. where like you can tell she's like aching to reach out, but at the same time, it's just like there's so much baggage that she can't overcome.
Right. And yeah, she's blocked herself off from the world in every way, like with the drinking, with the way she looks, you know, just with the way she carries herself. Anyway, so it's a fascinating character study, and I was really impressed by the extent to which Melissa McCarthy was able to stretch effectively. So
absolutely.
I am saying 8.8.
I said 8.5.
All right, 8.7 is our number. It's at 100%, you guys, on the tomato meter, which is hard to achieve, and I'm guessing that somebody at some point is going to come along and destroy that. But for now, it's still at 100%, and it's, I think, maybe just in New York and LA this week because it's, like, potentially an awards contender-y thing.
I'm sure they're thinking of it that way. And actually, in one of several films directed by women opening this week, I think.
Are there?
I got to pull the list up, but there were a couple things I was like, oh, okay, interesting.
Well, also, so an interesting directorial debut this week we have from Paul Dano. It's a movie called Wildlife, starring Carey Mulligan and Jake Gyllenhaal. And Dano also co-wrote the script with his longtime partner in love and work, Zoe Kazan. So what is that about?
So this is based on a Richard Ford novel, and it is about a married couple in the 1950s. living in Montana. The husband has been hired as a golf pro, so they've moved to this town. But then he loses the job, and it reveals a lot of the fractures in their relationship. He finally takes a gig as a firefighter for these like fires that are rampaging through mountains that are, you know, not all that nearby. So it's going to take him away until the snows come in. And the wife sort of takes this as an opportunity to sort of reinvent herself, and you know, she changes her look, she changes the way she behaves, and starts taking up with another fella. And all of this is being sort of witnessed by their young teenage son, who's trying to sort of process it all and keep things together. The husband is Jake Gyllenhaal. The wife is Carrie Mulligan. I was going to say Emily Mortimer. Carrie Mulligan. And the son is Ed Oxenbould, who was Alexander in Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, whatever. and also played the sidekick in Better Watch Out. I don't know if you saw that movie last year. It was a holiday horror movie that I'm a big fan of.
Of course you did.
I don't like all of them, but I liked this one. The thing about this movie is that it is a story you've seen a million times. Like, you know, we talk about this where like Sundance makes a certain kind of movie over and over again, you know. But every so often you see somebody do that well. Like when we saw Other People, it was like, okay, this is a movie about a dying mom, but it's actually done interestingly. This is a, you know, 1950s family falls apart movie that I felt like I'd seen a million times before, but they do it very well here. Like, Dano has a very assured eye as a director, both in terms of the performances, which you would expect from an actor-director, but just the landscape, the way he sort of captures the look of things. And I generally don't like Carey Mulligan, and she's great in this.
She's tremendous. Now, why do you not like her ordinarily?
I don't know. I don't know if it's the role she chooses, but I find her kind of one note and just sort of like she and Felicity Jones, I sort of put in this category of like, I'm not impressed. But here she gets to do things and there's a lot of layers to this character and she's thoroughly compelling.
It's a really complicated role and she's a potentially really unlikable woman because she makes decisions that are selfish and selfish for the first time in her life, perhaps. You learn over the course of the film that she got married young, that she had the son, that she's like 34 years old and she has a 14-year-old son. So she was pretty young when she became a mom. And so she never got to become her own person. You know, all those years where you're finding out who you are and making your mistakes, she didn't get to do that because she had all these responsibilities. And so, again, that's also part of kind of the cliche of this formula. But the character is written so richly and such a vivid sense of place in this small town in Montana. From the clothes to just the tone in her voice, there's like a depth and a coldness to the tone of her voice that is just chilling, you know. She still has to go through all the motions of doing all the mom stuff, but you realize increasingly that she's just not really interested in that.
Yeah.
And that's really sad, but also exciting for her.
Yeah. And the movie, I don't think paints her as a villain for that, which is interesting, even though we're seeing it all through the son's eyes and he's sort of horrified by some of what's happening. She still comes off as like, you know, a woman in that time and place who is sort of having to go to extremes to be able to have an identity, you know.
But she's not like a put upon little wife. I mean, you see early on in these scenes, she has her shit together and she's in command. I mean, early on when her son's doing his homework, I mean, she's like over his shoulder correcting him on tiny things in a very authoritative, like kind and loving, but really assured, really authoritative way. And that's who she is.
And when Jake Gyllenhaal can't get it together to like find other work, she's like, all right, fine. I'm working now.
I'm going to go to the Y and I'm going to teach swim classes.
Yeah, like,
you
this
know?
Is what's happening. I'm not, you know, you might not like it, but, you know. And I like how the movie captures, like, the kid's point of view in terms of not the conversations that he half hears, you know, like through the wall or, you know, like coming out in the middle of the night and seeing that, you know, one or the other parent is sleeping on the sofa, you know, like kind of the little clues that he's having to cobble together because no one's sitting him down and telling him here's what's going
on. Or there is somebody else in the house. So you have Bill Camp in a supporting role as a nice guy, you know. He's divorced, right? Or is he a widow?
I think he's divorced. I forget.
Yeah, he's single and he's available. And again, as a part of Carrie Mulligan's pragmatism, and she sees that and is like, ah, okay, well, maybe here's a way out.
Right.
And he's the wealthy car salesman, and in this small town, he's, you know, one of the big wigs. And again, you kind of don't fault her for it because she's really clear-eyed in her purpose. She wants a better life for herself and her son. She doesn't love Jake Gyllenhaal anymore. And she's got to figure things out. And she just does. She doesn't wait for somebody to come rescue her. She, like, takes the bull by the horns and does that for herself. So as fucked up as a lot of it is, like, I really admire her her backbone in doing all that stuff.
So there's a lot to like here. I mean, it's... I have to admit, the first half of me, I was like, I just like this again. But but as it went along, it kind of, I warmed to it and realized, okay, they're finding new ways to tell this and little subtleties, and it's worth it just, again, to look at it and to see these performances.
I really appreciate, and again, not surprising, but Paul Dano really lets his actors act, and the takes are long.
Yeah.
You know, individual scenes of dialogue are very long, and he will hold a shot and let the innate emotion of the words play out. But it's also visually quite lovely. There are some images that are very painterly. Like, he evokes a kind of romanticism of the 1950s, even in this kind of bleak, kind of bland small town. There's a shot of the sun, and like, he, it's nighttime and the light is kind of hitting half of him, and it's sort of painterly and beautiful. And so he's got an eye for artistry here, as well as, you know, an ear for dialogue, clearly.
And a moment even where, like, the change in the weather sort of like signals, you know, like signals,
the snow starts to fall.
Signals the next act, basically. It was like, you know, very subtly done, but well done.
It was very good, yeah. So I'm saying 8.6.
I said 7.5. And, you know, if I see it again, I might like it more.
Okay. If I can maybe on the record of saying, I always liked Carrie Mulligan. I loved her in An Education. I liked her in Shame.
I liked her in Education. I hated her in Shame. She was terrible.
But it's a rare contemporary role for her. She never gets to play anybody. I didn't like the one where she gets to vote.
Oh, Suffragette.
Was it called Suffragette? Yeah, was it that simple?
Yeah, didn't see it.
Anyway, so I like Carrie Mulligan just fine. So our number is an 8.1. Is at 98% on the tomato meter.
She's no Gemma Arterton, is all I'm saying.
You are a fan of hers. So real fast, we are in award season now, officially. Uh-huh. The Gotham Awards nominations were announced this morning. I had the pleasure of being on the committee that chose the nominees for Best Feature and Breakthrough Director and Best Screenplay.
Nice.
So that is always an honor and a treat with my fellow critics. So the Gotham Awards are sort of like the Spirit Awards, but they're in New York.
Basically, yeah. Is it the same structure as far as like what can be nominated in terms of like budget and that sort of thing?
Budget and, you know, in terms of
has to have played one of these festivals.
I believe with Gothams, they have to have played theatrically. Right? Because, like, the Spirit Awards, they can qualify.
There's some that haven't opened yet, though, like The Favorite.
Or they will play theatrically, at least.
Oh,
I mean, because there are things like The Rider played last year at festivals, but then came out theatrically this year. And was nominated by the Spirits last year, and
Gotham's
now is in the Gothams this year. So anyway, let me get to that real fast. The Best Feature nominees are First Reformed, The Favorite, Madeline's Madeline, If Beale Street Could Talk, and The Rider.
I have not seen Madeline's Madeline, but I've heard good things, and I can't wait to see if Beale Street Could Talk.
Beale Street is beautiful, and see it on a giant screen.
Okay.
I would like to have a conversation when the film comes out just about Barry Jenkins' use of the colors red and green. It is gorgeous. It's just poetic and swoony. Also, I was on the committee that picked Breakthrough Director. That would be Bo Burnham for Eighth Grade, Ari Aster for Hereditary, Boots Riley for Sorry to Bother You, Crystal Mozell for Skate Kitchen, and Jennifer Fox for The Tale.
So these aren't necessarily first films because Jennifer Fox is... Jennifer Fox? Wait.
Crystal Mozell did a documentary prior.
I'm thinking of Jennifer Kent. Sorry.
Right.
These are all first narrative features?
Yes, that's what that is. Yeah, because actually somebody pointed that out on Twitter, like, wait, I like Skate Kitchen, but I don't get how that's a breakthrough because it's not her first film. I think it's like best narrative feature
first non-scripted feature.
There you go.
Andy Timoner schooled me on that.
Our screenplay nominees are The Favorite, Thoroughbred, which I loved.
That choice had Christy Lemire written all over it.
It's cold and bitchy like me. First Reform, Paul Schrader's script for First Reform.
Yay.
Private Life.
Nice.
Yes, and Support the Girls.
Thank you.
Yes, which I know you liked very much. So that's an interesting cross-section of folks. Best Actor, the nominations are Adam Driver in Black Klansman, Ben Foster in Leave No Trace, Richard E. Grant, which we just got done talking about, in Can You Ever Forgive Me, Ethan Hawke in First Reformed, and Lakeith Stanfield in Sorry to Bother You.
Are there supportings?
No.
Oh, okay. That explains it. Both Adam Driver and Richard E. Grant, I would think of as supporting performance.
Yeah, I know. Actress is Glenn Close in The Wife, Toni Collette in Hereditary. Nice. Yeah, I hope they keep that going. Katherine Hahn in Private Life. Nice. Regina Hall, who we loved in Support the Girls. And Michelle Pfeiffer in Where is Kira? Mm. And they gave a special jury award for ensemble performance for Olivia Colman, Emma Stone, and Rachel Weisz in The Favorite, which I am looking forward to talking about with you.
Me too.
Yes, and what they do, which is different, is they do a Breakthrough Actor Award, which could be actor or actress. And in this case, it is five women, which I love. All right. It's Thomasin Harcourt in Leave No Trace, Helena Howard in Madeline's Madeline, who is a total find, and we will talk about that at some point, I hope. Kiki Lane in Beale Street, Elsie Fisher in Eighth Grade, and Yalitza Aparicio in Roma. So a lot of these are films that I have seen that I don't know if you've seen yet. We got to talk about when they come out theatrically.
Yalitza Aparicio is my best actress choice for this year, period.
She's amazing.
In Roma. She's so great.
I can't wait to talk about Roma with you.
Oh, God.
I was sobbing.
Amazing, amazing movie.
Yes, it's gorgeous. So the Gotham Awards come out. There's a big ceremony they do in New York. I want to say it is November 26th. The Spirit Award nominations come out, I want to say, like November 16th. So it's all coming. And then our LA Film Critics picks, we do what, like December 2nd or something like that?
First half of December.
Pretty soon. So it's all coming together. The awards picture, I do not necessarily see any one front runner yet, but there are lots of ones that are poking their heads up.
And again, obviously, these are awards contenders of a very specific ilk, you know, like, so
not the Oscars.
Exactly. No. A lot of your big budget studio stuff is not in the running here because it costs too much.
There's no A Star Is Born.
Exactly. So we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But all right, well, an interesting choice. I'll be curious to see how that impacts the spirits, if at all.
Yes.
You know? I don't care about the Oscars as a thing unto itself, but I do like the fact that they will nudge people to go see a movie they might otherwise have missed that's worthy of merit. And I think the Spirits and the Gothams are better, or like pick better movies to nudge people to go see. And I hope that those nominations do, you know, put some butts in seats.
Yeah, I think that there is the overriding concern that we should use our light to shine on things for good, smaller things for good that maybe you wouldn't see, because everyone's going to go see A Star Is Born, for example. So if we have the opportunity to send folks toward Madeline's Madeline, which is small and challenging and weird and joyful, like, hey, why not? So let me recap real fast what we did today. We talked about Halloween. We gave it a 6.5. Can You Ever Forgive Me? We gave an 8.7. Wildlife, an 8.1. And 22 July, a 7.6. And if you're just now tuning in, you missed Ben. thank you for sticking around. Next week is Suspiria.
Yes, it is. We have some exciting news coming up very soon that will answer all your questions about, are we going to talk about TV? Are we going to be available on Apple Podcasts? All that stuff. We're working on it. We're putting it all together. And once it's ready to be presented to the world, we will tell you all about it, because we're not going anywhere. We like working together. We like hanging out once a week. So we're going to keep this train rolling.
Indeed. And so thank you all for asking and caring. And we will see you again next week.
I want to plug something real quick.
Honey, yeah.
On Friday, October 26th at 7 p.m. Pacific time, I have never seen Hocus Pocus.
Why? How is that possible?
Because I just didn't. I was in my 20s when it came out. Mm-hmm. And all the young gays have been horrified at this for years because, you know, the ones in their 20s grew up on this movie and they just think that it's holy writ. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to watch it for the first time and I'm going to live tweet it on the Linoleum Podcast Twitter at LinoleumCast. So if you want to watch me watch this movie and watch along with me, check that out. It's going to be hashtag LK Hocus Pocus.
Okay, well, go get on the Twitters for that. If you're not already on them, get on them now. All right. Thank you, Alonzo.
Thank you,
Ben, wherever you are. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.